financial support of our members. And I would urge you to join the Institute if you have not already done so. Membership fees are modest and they are tax deductible. The Institute also relies on larger donations. And this year and in next year, in 1994, we are making a special appeal. The late Belle Nemetz headed the program committee of the Institute for many years and set the high standards of Institute lecturers that we continue to enjoy. The Institute is what it is today, largely through her untiring efforts. To honor her memory and to assist in continuing the quality of program upon which she insisted, the Institute has established the Belle Nemetz Memorial Lecture Fund to assist in defraying expenses of lecturers from afar. The Vancouver Foundation has graciously agreed to match contributions to the fund up to $25,000 in each of 1993 and 1994, so that gifts from members and supporters have double value to the fund. The Institute is grateful to those who have already contributed to this fund, and we invite contributions from others who are able to do so. This evening, we are departing from tradition. Through the very kind auspices of the Vancouver Greek community, there will be a reception following tonight's lecture, to which all of the audience is invited in the main foyer in front of this lecture theater. And those in charge of the reception would like an indication of those who are able to stay for the reception, coffee, and a suite. And I wonder if I could have a show of hands, please, of those who are able to remain for the benefit of the organizers. Thanks very much. Before introducing tonight's speaker, may I remind you that next Saturday evening, Dr. Mark Fruin, the director of the Institute of Asian Research at UBC, will talk on the subject, Knowledge-Based Competition, the Japanese Challenge. Our guest tonight is Professor Stella Miller Collett, the leading authority in North America on the archaeology of Macedonia. Her interest in the history and archaeology of Macedonia commenced with her doctoral dissertation. She has participated in numerous excavations in Greece, including Corinth, the Athenian Agora, and Nemea. She has been associated for many years with the American School of Classical Studies at Athens. She has taught at the University of California at Berkeley, at Stanford University, and presently at the University of Cincinnati. Our Institute brochure has incorrectly attributed to her the discovery of the tomb thought to be that of Philip II, father of Alexander the Great, which was in fact located by the late Manolis Andronikos of the University of Salonika. Some of her finds, however, are less spectacular than that tomb only by comparison. At present, Professor Miller Collett is involved in new excavations at Troy in Turkey. Her primary interest, however, continues to be Macedonia, and that is her focus tonight. Tombs and treasures of ancient Macedonia, recent discoveries in northern Greece. Professor Miller Collett.
Thank you so much for the warm introduction on this cold night. Gratifying to see how many people have come out on this snowy evening to hear about Macedonia, which is of burning interest to me, certainly. The fact that I am the leading authority in North America sort of hits by default. There aren't very many of us, actually, who work on it, I must tell you. But I do devote my life to it, and have for some years, and love it dearly. Would that I had been so lucky to have found the tomb associated with Philip. But I will tell you about some of the new finds in Macedonia. And why don't we start with the slides right away? I think actually I control that. And perhaps turn the lights down. Or do these stay on? Simply because I think you can see better, which is part of the point, after all, isn't it? Macedonia is hot news at the moment. Everyone knows that, reading our newspapers, and we are all certainly aware of what's going on in Macedonia. But do you know to what degree Macedonia is hot news in the ancient front, the antiquities that are being discovered in Macedonia now? And that is my line of expertise, of course. It's that I want to share with you this evening, some of the finds. Because, you know, this is where the real action in Greek archaeology is right now, one of the major fronts of developments in ancient Macedonia. Tombs and Treasures is the title, the basic title of my talk. We will be looking at some tombs and treasures, certainly, but that's only part of the news, the exciting archaeological news out of Macedonia right now. There is, in fact, an embarrassment of riches. So I have had, in trying to choose what to say in the relatively short time, I have a captive audience here, to choose among a great number of things to share with you. So we will be looking at an assortment of things that I have chosen as kind of a highlight, starting with a few things I think that will be familiar to you, and then moving on to some that are newer and really hot out of the ground so far. It's hard to keep, as an archaeologist myself involved in Macedonian antiquities, it's hard to keep really abreast of the latest things. So many developments are happening so rapidly. Looking at a personification, of course, on a Roman mosaic, a personification of Macedonia, and on the opposite, you will, of course, have recognized Alexander the Great in one of the many portraits we have of him. And I start with him because, in a sense, Alexander is at the basis of it all. Alexander started it all in the sense of the world perception. This is true in antiquity as it is today. Everyone knows something about Alexander. So he's a good starting point, certainly. But it is, in modern terms, the gentleman on the left whom you were heard of in a moment ago. This is Professor Manolis Andronikos, the late Professor Andronikos, who died just in this last year, who was the gentleman who really put Macedonia, the antiquities of Macedonia, on the map for us in modern times. A scant 15 years ago, when he found the tomb, which he associated with Philip, that we see on the other screen. The questions that has given rise to are very significant and very deep. They play a role in any studies we are doing, historical and archaeological, with Macedonia. They also are controversial, I have to tell you. But I would like to pay tribute to the memory of Professor Andronikos. This is certainly appropriate as we start looking at the finds from Macedonia. Because really, it's as a result of his discovery of this very tomb, seeing the facade of it here in a drawing so that we can see more detail of it, his discovery of this tomb just over 15 years ago started a great series of discoveries, partly because the contents of this tomb, and I will show you just a few of the objects that have come from it. Much of this will be familiar to you, but perhaps not a bad thing to look. The great treasure chest, which contains the bones of the deceased. And you can see on the other screen, you can see a cutaway, give you an idea of the way it looked with all the materials that were found inside. I don't think my pointer is showing. Let me just make sure that we get it here. with the drawing there of some of the great finds. The development as a result of this great discovery of Professor Andronikos, it caused excitement. It caused excitement in the archaeological world, certainly, people like me and my many colleagues, among the lay public also, the populace at large. It caused money to become available, and it made possible a great amount of excavation and discoveries that took place in the subsequent years, and we are still grateful for this kind of beginning. So Alexander on the ancient front can stand for a beginning, and Professor Andronikos on the modern side as a beginning in our discoveries and our dealing with the archaeology of Macedonia. The silver cups, we could easily spend the entire time this evening looking just at the finds from the tomb of Philip, as it is often called, and I show you just a small selection. The variety of objects, from precious materials, from tiny to large scale, whether it's small gold and small ivory, as we have it here, up to much, much larger scale. On many different levels, this is a staggering find, and it remains to be fully assessed, fully evaluated. There is a great deal more material in this tomb that is awaiting conservation, restoration, study, scientific study, before we can really approach all the more complicated historical questions involved in it. And what I mean in part by those complicated historical questions have to do with the identity of the person who was buried in here. As you will know, most of you already, of course, Professor Andronikos called this the Tomb of Philip. And among the finds inside, a series of heads, very small heads, the size of your thumbnail, were found, including these two, which are thought to be the likenesses, very likely, of Philip on the one screen, the older man, and his son, Alexander the Great. Whether or not this is the actual tomb of Philip, and whether the bones in that casket are the bones of Philip, has not been decided to everyone's satisfaction yet. As I say, we need to await the full study of all the material that has been found in it and to establish the exact chronology. It's a fascinating question. It's one everyone will be hearing more about as time goes on. I myself am passionately interested. One could ask, is it totally important? I have been asked this. Does it matter a great deal whether this is Philip or not? And the answer is, I would say, certainly, of course it matters. It matters from a historical point of view, certainly, and I would say that all archaeology, as a classical archaeologist, I consider myself a historian. I'm dealing with material of history, and even with each of these beautiful objects we've been looking at now and will be looking for the next hour, one can certainly admire them as great works of art in themselves. That's legitimate, and that is one aspect of what we do. But looking at them in their context, looking at them together, looking at these heads, looking at the small gold and ivory objects, looking at the cups we saw, and other objects, looking at these, putting them together as the objects which accompanied a dead man, what does this tell about that dead man? What does it tell about the society of Macedonia in the later 4th century, as there is no question these are of the later 4th century? This is all enormously important, and if we can attach these objects that have been found with a historical figure, that is tremendously important. We will have to wait for the final answer on that, as I say. There are other ways, though, in which archaeology and discoveries in Macedonia are dealing with the historical question, ways that might not have thought about exactly. When people think of history, we tend often, of course, to think of the written sources, Herodotus, Thucydides, of course, but archaeology as a historical branch can produce not only objects like this, but also the written record. We are unlikely to find more chapters of A Herodotus or A Thucydides. What we can find for actual written record is occasionally, when we're lucky, inscriptions. And when we're especially lucky, inscriptions which tell us things that fill in little pieces of our historical record. I sometimes think of archaeology as a kind of vast mosaic, and we are working with a less than complete picture. We're lucky enough to be working with less than a complete picture, I would say, because it is then part of the scientific excitement of, in the course of excavating, to find little pieces that will fit into that greater mosaic and help us amplify the historical picture. The particular inscriptions that I chose are recent finds and are enormously important in their own way. One of them, the one here on your left, is a treaty, a fragment of a treaty, of course, of Philip, the very Philip we are speaking of, and concerns a treaty with a city, the city of the Lysimachians. It's off in on the Bosphorus now. The one on the other side is an inscription of his son, of Alexander the Great, no less, and deals with, in the very last year of Alexander's life, it can be quite closely dated, deals with the allotting of royal lands by Alexander to faithful followers, his companions. So here is another way that archaeology amplifies the historical picture. I'd like to back up for just a moment, though, and look at what we are speaking of on the map, refresh our memories. On the one screen, of course, we have Alexander's empire going all the way, the great stretch from Macedonia proper up here, all the way over to India and through all the countries here, of modern countries that are in the news for the various reasons that we all know, down into Egypt as well, of course. In Macedonia, this is Greek Macedonia, and of course I am speaking tonight of the new discoveries in Greek Macedonia to remind you of the heartland of that, with modern Thessaloniki right here. We have various cities I will be talking about. I could, in the embarrassment of riches there are, could skip over all parts of Macedonia and show you new discoveries, but in my choices I've had to make, we were just at Vergina. I'm pointing approximately where Vergina is, I think. I can't quite see it myself, but it is along in there. Vergina, the ancient earliest capital of the Macedonians and the burial spot of its kings. Then we will look at Pella, which is about here, the later capital, the capital in the age of Philip and Alexander, the greatest city in Macedonia, as it was called in Alexander's own day. But the breadth and depth of finds, we'll go briefly to the site of Dion, right in there at the foot of Mount Olympus, an incredibly important sanctuary of the Macedonians. I will allude to finds that are being found off in western Macedonia, up in the mountains. There are very exciting excavations taking place there right now, which are producing new and different things that are changing our historical perspective. I'll show you some things that come from right near Thessaloniki, from the outskirts of Thessaloniki. We could spend time looking at things found in the Chalcidice. We could go along here all out through Thrace. The whole area is full of new discoveries, and in fact, archaeologists, colleagues are working in this whole large area, working very closely together in what in antiquity was Macedonia and Thrace, as it is very closely connected. We'll go first back to Vergina, where the tomb that is associated with Philip was found, and I'll show you a few more things from that important place. The theater, which you see in detail on the left, is a discovery of Professor Andronicus's of about within the last 10 years or so. You can see in the larger view on the right, you see the Great Palace, a palace which was used. It's not the royal palace at this period in the 4th century, but an ancillary palace. And at the foot, you can see there where the theater is located. This is the theater which, according to Professor Andronicus's interpretation, is where Philip was assassinated. Again, a great deal more remains to be learned about this. Since this discovery and the current assessment that is continuing on it, the assessment of the small finds that will give us the precise dating in particular, excavations have expanded beyond this, below the theater, and down into the ancient city. This is tremendously exciting. Public buildings are being found, sanctuaries, houses, stoas, being part of the political structure of the town. We're looking here at part of a sanctuary, and it's a particular sanctuary, a sanctuary to a goddess, Greek goddess Euclia is her name, and in that sanctuary, the detail right here is of a statue base. You can see the cuttings here on the top where a statue once stood, dedicated to Euclia, but the exciting part of it is really that it is dedicated by a woman who walks off our history pages, the mother of Philip. That much seems clear enough. With the name on it, and her father's name happens to be unusual enough that it must be that Eurydice who was the mother of Philip. Moving in Vergina, still, to another recent discovery of just the last couple of years, made still during Andronicus's lifetime, not yet published in full, only in preliminary reports, is a tomb, another Macedonian tombs, as these great tombs with their facades are called. Another Macedonian tomb of which you see the somewhat littered inside and a detail of the throne that you can make out in the corner over on the left screen, you see in the detail on the right. This was looted. The exciting thing about the tomb associated with Philip is that it was unlooted, and we have all the riches and treasures there. As we know, unfortunately, there are tomb robbers. They've been busy since antiquity, actually, wherever they could find gold and objects of this sort, but in modern times, unfortunately, also. The tomb was found looted. There were, fortunately, some small bits of material left, some bits of gold, some bits of pottery, which are very important as we archaeologists date our material on the basis of pottery, and this incredibly precious throne. Now, Professor Andronicus believed that this was the throne of none other than Eurydice, the mother of Philip. We found the inscription in the sanctuary, not far away from this. This was the tomb of a woman. Macedonian men didn't wear earrings, and an earring was found, missed by the looters, underneath the throne right here. It certainly was a woman's tomb. It is a possibility. It could be, I suppose. The chronology remains to be seen. But he associated it with Eurydice. To show you a detail of the best part preserved, the horses on the back of the throne, this is tremendously exciting. I don't have time to show you a great number of the tomb paintings that have been discovered. They have changed our understanding of ancient painting. The books that used to be that told us in theory what ancient painting was about, based on literary sources, based on bits of pottery that have pictures on them, have been totally changed among the many things that are developing from Macedonia, as we are finding really and truly masterpieces of painting. The subject matter on this tomb back, and you see it as it was found, it hasn't yet been fully cleaned, just a detail of the horses there, which remarkably remained as fresh as you see it. The subject matter has to do with Persephone, the rape of Persephone by Pluto. You remember the story where she's taken by Pluto to the underworld and plea bargains. Eventually, her mother plea bargains and gets her back for half the year, and that's how the seasons change. Well, this, of course, has a significance also in terms of the not only the cycles of vegetation, but the cycles of life and death. So Persephone occupies an important role in the iconography of death in Macedonia, as it does throughout the Greek world, to be sure. So on many levels, this is enormously important. Near this tomb is another grave that was discovered a few years ago by Professor Andronicus. I can't resist showing you a little more of some of this incredible painting. This is another tomb with a cycle also of Demeter and Persephone. And you see here Persephone is seated mourning the loss of her daughter. It's winter time, in other words. Persephone's in the underworld. She's sitting at the back of this chamber here. And most spectacularly, that part which shows, so graphically shows, the carrying off of Persephone to the underworld as Pluto grabs her. Well, these tombs and the material we've looked at here at Vergina really are associated with whether this really is Eurydice, as remains to be seen, whether it really is Philip, as also remains to be further debated, and I hope to be decided on a scientific basis definitively. This is basically dealing with the upper classes and with royalty. To show you, to give you an idea of what else there is, I want to proceed from there to what else there is. This is a poster that you see here on the left of a selection of a few of the Macedonian tombs that have been discovered, most of them fairly recently. The tomb count, my last count had it up to close to 100 of these Macedonian tombs, large chamber tombs, which we see basically facades on that side and one of the tombs in a blow-up right here. It is this one, which also happens to be at Regina and has paintings on it. These tombs, mostly looted, a few precious ones unlooted, basically belong to upper classes, if not to royalty, perhaps to a combination of both of them, and are scattered throughout Macedonia. They have been found way off in the west. Recently, one has been found in the western mountains of Macedonia. They have been found way off as far as Drama, if you go to the east, considerably off in modern-day Thrace. But this is not the whole story. Archaeology, in its search for filling out the mosaic of history, and in the case of Macedonia in particular, we're no longer looking just, as we once did, just at the upper classes, the ruling class in Macedonia, or if we are in Athens, the Parthenon, and the people who were associated with the Parthenon. We're taking a broader view now and trying to put together the whole story as best we can. It's a big task as we try to see the whole story and what people, common people, also were doing. The middle classes, the lower classes. From this we learn, all right, we may not get as many goodies as such, not as much gold, but we are learning really about society in this way, the economic structure, the social structure, to amplify what we have in our written textbooks. So to stand for this other aspect of the Macedonian world, moving from the glamour of the spectacular finds in Vergina, a couple of grave stelae, grave markers, with common men on them will stand for these types. And we will look at some of those things to try to give you a better picture also what archaeology is about and why Macedonia is leading the way, really, in aspects of studying these people as a whole. We'll go to Pella for this. Pella, where great excavations are going on. Pella excavations were started some 30 years ago or so, but the vast impetus has been now just in the last 15 or so. A plan of the city has been put together, a great grid plan. There is a palace, certainly. This is the palace, or a later phase of the palace, where Philip and Alexander sat and presumably were born. The grid pattern of the city, there are lots of holes in it that need to be filled out with excavation, but you can see a cluster right in here. We're going to look at one of the buildings first in this cluster, which is a house located right in here. It's the House of Dionysus, as it's called. We see part of it here in the foreground. Now, although this is not a brand new find, the House of Dionysus, and some of you who have been to Pella will recognize it. What is new is the full study of this for the first time. There is a book that has been published by Greek colleagues just out on the subject of the House of Dionysus. We get a beautiful plan of the house here, and I think from the aerial view on the opposite screen, you can orient yourself very well. Spacious house. We are down in the center of the town. This isn't a poor man's house, of course, but it also isn't a royal house. It remains to be seen as we dig more and discover more houses, how we can fit this precisely into the society as a whole. What kind of person will have been here? But what's exciting, looking at this house, the House of Dionysus, to stand for houses that are being found at many other spots in Macedonia now, in the Hellenistic period. I'm staying in the 4th century for the moment with all of this. We can put this together, and we can see what a house looked like. We have the elements of the house, an example of an Ionic capital on the one screen, and then a model that has been put together of the house. And you can see the courtyards, and you recognize this as what we were just looking at in the aerial view and on the plan. So we are beginning to get a very real picture of a house. We can go beyond this. We can furnish it. We can look inside and see what kinds of things it looked like. It takes its name, this particular house, from the mosaic that you see here, which will be familiar to many of you, the Dionysus mosaic, found 30 years ago or so. But now it fits into the whole pattern and the full study of the house. We can see what its walls looked like. The particular house here, the walls in stucco, and they are of a height that's perhaps two-thirds the height of the wall in the front of this auditorium here, to give you an idea of the scale. It's two-story high. This particular wall here, I must tell you, does not come from the House of Dionysus. It comes from a neighboring house, but it's the kind of stucco wall decoration that there was in the House of Dionysus, just didn't happen to be preserved quite so well. But it gives us an idea of the interior, luxurious tapestry-like rugs made of mosaic, more practical than a rug, isn't it? And then these fine stucco walls. No paintings yet on the walls, although I'd predict that we're going to find them. We can furnish the house. A table at Pella on the one side, which is a kind of marble with inlays on it. And on that table, we can place all sorts of objects. You look at this and think, well, but it looks like it's gold, and does gold fit into a house like this? In fact, it is not gold. It is a poor man's version of gold. You can see there are some spots on here. That's not discoloration. It's where the gold flaked off. It is, in fact, a clay cup which has been gilded with gold plate. So it's a fake. This cup wasn't a fake, in quotation marks, of course. This particular cup was not found in the house either. It was found in a grave, and the graves of Pella are very rich and fascinating also. There are several graveyards which are in the process of being excavated. This is the kind of grave we get for our middle class, as we now understand it, a much more modest affair than the great Macedonian tombs with their facades, which can have architecture, which can have paintings, thrones inside even. These are smaller. They're about the size, the length of them is about the size of a human body, and the height of it is a meter or so. And they can, you see, on the one hand where it's just, this tomb is just being opened, and on the other side, look, peering into it, and there are some grave goods in this one, some metal objects, could be various things. I'll give you an example of a tomb at Pella that had, obviously it's a woman's tomb. Women's tomb tend to have the gold, the jewelry, the splashy stuff. It's fun, of course. Men's tombs, we'll see an example, will have military objects and may have pots in them. But this necklace, this fine necklace, we're in the 4th century still. This could be the lady of the house of the house of Dionysus. We can't prove that. Was found together with a variety of objects, including this statuette of a goddess. Maybe it's Demeter herself. And you may be able to tell that she's wearing a necklace that actually looks quite a bit like the real necklace that was worn by Our Lady who was buried here. To go back to the plan and look at another aspect of Pella now, the graves come from the cemeteries that are actually on both sides, eastern and western sides of the city itself. But to look at, we were just at the house of Dionysus here, you remember. Look at something else, a new development right in here, that big square open area. That's not because we don't know what it is. That has been discovered. You don't see it on here. This is the house of Dionysus. What you don't see in place of these fields here is this great square area. Aerial photographs haven't been made yet, or at least I don't have them available, of this new square. This is the agora, the marketplace, as we usually translate it, which, of course, is much more than a marketplace, although marketing did go on. It's a kind of nerve center for what was in any ancient city, Greek, in Macedonia as well. And it has on it, usually it will have a shrine or two. It will have public buildings. A mint can often be found there at Pella. The mint has been discovered at the northern end of the agora. Shops where crafts were sold, shops where crafts were made. And that's what we'll look at now a little bit, at some of the crafts that were produced on this side, on the eastern side here of the agora. These views show quite graphically, I think, what the archaeologists saw when they were excavating in here in some of the shops. It looks as though the shelves collapsed, doesn't it? And that's exactly what did happen. There was a destruction. It has been a working hypothesis. Archaeologists deal with working hypotheses a great deal. In the course of the archaeological work we do and the assessment and the knowledge that as we dig further, we will learn more details. But the working theory is that this must have been an earthquake that caused this rather than any kind of human destruction, simply by the absence of any kind of fire or destruction weapons or things of this sort, which we often find. So it was destroyed. We know the date when it was destroyed. It was in the early 1st century BC. And what it left behind was the ruins of shops. Now, the shops were of potters. We're looking in the destruction area of potters, obviously, here. But there also next door were terracotta figurine makers, figurine and statue makers. These are tremendously important discoveries like this for all sorts of reasons. Here you see on the right-hand screen, you see a modern positive that's been made with modern clay, of course, from the ancient mold that you see on the left. The mold is on the slides is a little bit smaller, but they do fit. One comes from the other. This is a little bit over life size, by the way, the head that comes that we are looking at. The importance of finding shops like this go far beyond, well, the excitement. Here are a whole lot of pots, and here are objects and interesting figurines and statues that can be found. That's interesting, of course. But on the broader scale, it tells us, of course, some of the occupations of the people who lived in Pella, the craftsman class, shall we say, who lived in Pella. It tells us the kinds of crafts that were needed locally to be produced right there. And then, on the broader scale, as we learn more, as we study more, as we discuss, share, talk with our colleagues, as I do, for instance, and have been with my colleague Hector Williams, sitting right here, digging on Mytilene, we share the results of our finds, and we compare things, and we look to see where imports and exports are discovered. Now, this is not done just by looking, of course. We have scientific testing of the materials. But we can do this on a broader scale, in a cooperative effort, and gradually we are learning, gradually we are putting together a broader picture of the discoveries and what materials were traveling and what materials. So we're getting a bigger economic picture of what was going on in the ancient world by this means. Tremendously important, really. I mentioned that on the agora in Pella, the mint was found. In that mint were great quantities of coins, coins that date back. There were pockets of coins that date back to the age of Alexander. There were coins of various periods, which help us date the destruction of it. But it introduces, I'll give us a couple of figures who loom large in the history of Macedonia. As I shift to move down a little bit to the later history of Macedonia. We've looked briefly, very briefly now, just at the period, the Hellenistic period, the age of Philip and Alexander and their successors over the next couple hundred years. Then we come, of course, to the Roman phase and the phase the Romans conquered Macedonia. They conquered all of Greece. They conquered all the whole Mediterranean, as everyone knows. And we are coming to document this more and more clearly in Macedonia. The coins that we're looking at here are of two figures who played an important role in the historical events as Rome and Macedonia came to a head, basically. It was a long struggle as Rome sought to take over from the power of Macedonia. And our figures include here on this screen here a gold coin of a Roman figure, Flamininus is his name, a Roman general, who was in direct conflict with the latter-day namesake of Philip, Alexander's father. This is Philip V, who reigned in the later 3rd century and the 2nd century and had a great number of dealings and beginnings of losses to the Romans. Coins can tell us, in other words, a great deal, not only of the appearance of our figures, but as we find them and as we recognize the figures from the historical record of Philip, we can date the material that was found together with that. The finds of Roman Macedonia. Roman, when exactly do we mean Roman Macedonia? This is difficult because, of course, it didn't just suddenly happen. Rome took over and everything became Roman. The Macedonians continued to live there, to work there, to produce. So it is a little bit difficult to say. Unfortunately, that lady wound up on her side. We changed carousel systems at the last moment. She slipped, unfortunately. But you can see her nonetheless. We have here standing for some of our Roman figures and some discoveries in Macedonia of Roman figures, a golden bust. It is gold. It's not solid, but it is strong gold, a life-size head of a Roman emperor. It is probably the Emperor Marcus Aurelius. that is not agreed upon by everybody, but you're getting the picture. I think that archaeologists have a lot of discussion and disagreement and a lot of questioning of each other and on interpretations. But it is a Roman emperor, and it probably dates to the 2nd century A.D., which period of time is certainly fully Roman. And the lady standing on her side, on her ear here, comes from the site of Verdia, which many of you will know, I dare say, and will stand for an upper-class Roman lady, anonymous at this time. But a great deal of study is going on right now concerning Roman Macedonia, the Roman figures, Roman archaeology, and inscriptions as well, of which we have an enormous number. To choose of the many possibilities to talk about just one site to stand for the Roman period, I'm taking us to Dion. Dion at the foot of Mount Olympus, the site that was, from very early days, the leading sanctuary of the Macedonians, patterned rather after the Olympic Games, which we all know. An aerial view on the left screen shows us one of the major roads that goes through Dion. It shows us a Roman concert hall. There are baths, there are buildings, there are sanctuaries. All sorts of things have been found at Dion. It is one of the most exciting places, Roman discoveries right now. They are so well preserved. There's no town sitting directly on top of it. This is one of the reasons. This is the theater of the Hellenistic age originally, although it was rebuilt in the Roman period. And it's here, as some of you know, that there are theatrical productions sometimes in the summer, and one can see a reenactment of Antigone or whatever, as one did in antiquity. Of the sanctuaries at Dion, an important sanctuary that has been discovered here, and the excavator is a colleague at the University of Thessaloniki, Dimitris Pandermalis, has been working here for a number of years against odds of water. What you see here is not just the kind of water or snow that has been falling on the west coast here, but it is right beside a riverbed and is constantly flooded. But it's a sanctuary of Isis, the Egyptian goddess Isis. You can see a head here that was a dedication by a priestess to Isis, just as it was being found in the ground, toppled next to the altar to the goddess Isis. Roman period, this is basically the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. There is also 1st century AD. In the city, among the very important recent discoveries, and you can see this is the continuation of that very road we were looking at a moment ago, you can see how roads have been found crisscrossing. These are the ancient roads. And you can see how Professor Pandermalis has been working in one particular area and starting to uncover the antiquities there. This is a large, flourishing villa, a Roman villa, that is that you can see laid out with the rooms neatly delineated. It is under study. A shed roof, you can make out, has been put here. That is what protects a great mosaic, of which we see a detail right here, a head of the god Dionysus. Again, Dionysus, whom we saw at Pella, also on a mosaic. Dionysus, who is one of the very important gods of the Macedonians, as he is of the Greeks generally, but the Macedonians particularly liked him. We see all the cups, the drinking cups and articles for drinking of wine in the tombs and in the various cities. We know that the Macedonians certainly liked their wonderful wine, wonderful today and wonderful obviously in antiquity also. And then great riches of sculptures found throughout the city of the Roman period. And to show just an example, on the one screen is a philosopher type, one of a group of philosophers that were set up in the city. And as I paired the pictures, he's sort of gazing over at a statue of what at first glance may look to be Aphrodite. But if you glance a little longer, you'll see that it is a hermaphrodite, that was one of a whole grouping of figures, a popular kind of notion in antiquity. We're going to turn the clock backwards now a bit. We started at the, I think appropriately, at the nucleus of things with Alexander and his father Philip. We went forward to look a little bit at some of the discoveries of the Roman period, and now we'll go backwards and look at some of the discoveries from the two centuries before the age of Philip and Alexander. So, chronologically, obviously, we're talking about the 6th and 5th centuries BC. The two objects on the screen here stand for those two centuries. The Kouros, the nude male figure, large statue, stone statue on the one screen of the 6th century, and the bronze figure on the right of the 5th century. These two objects, the one, the male figure, it happens, comes from way, way off in the east, in Thrace, as we now call it, and the figure here on the female figure on the opposite screen, the bronze, comes from a figure way off in the mountains in the west. Both of these two areas are producing extremely rich new discoveries. If those two figures will stand for some of the sculptural discoveries of the classical and archaic periods, as we call the 5th and then the 6th centuries respectively, we're finding important monuments of the architecture as well. The column capital, the Ionic column capital there, is a find of a bunch of years ago from Thessaloniki, and long stood in absolute isolation. Thessaloniki is such a built-up city, as most of us know, it's very difficult to conduct excavations within the city. So there are some precious isolated finds, and there are some pockets of areas where material can be found. It stood in isolation. We knew very little. We knew almost nothing about the earlier phases of Macedonia before Philip and Alexander, and our history books are silent, virtually silent on the subject, so that archaeology now in this period is particularly important. And if I make a prediction, which I allow myself every once in a while, if I make a prediction, I really think that the classical and archaic periods of Macedonia are going to blossom and surprise us in ways that we haven't even dreamed of yet, and will be of great historic importance as learning of the ancestors and the antecedents of the age of Philip and Philip and Alexander of Macedon, and of the whole history of Greece itself, by extension, of course. Well, that splendid capital no longer stands in absolute isolation. Bits of other equally beautiful parts of temples are being found at several sites, but rather than show you more of that, I will just illustrate with a picture of some house walls that stand almost to the second story, dating to the 6th century. These particular houses come from a site in western Macedonia also. Looking at graves, which so often give us rich material, not just rich because of the materials themselves, gold and silver, sure, that is important without a question, but rich because of the complexes of material. And once we find one grave, we're in a graveyard, and the chances are good we will find, unless it's been built over, unless everything has been looted out, that we will find a lot of other graves as well, which can tell us an enormous amount about the history of a particular region. So tombs, and here you see a tomb. This is a recently discovered tomb. This one is particular one is at Vergina, once again, dates to the early 5th century. We're in the classical period here. Hasn't yet been even cleaned fully and taken apart, but you can see the wealth. These are silver and bronze objects. And in the larger picture here, of which you see a detail on the opposite screen, you can see this is a female burial. I think you can see glimmers of gold. She has gold all over her body. Can't show you the after pictures yet because it hasn't been taken out and fully restored and isn't visible. But what I can do is show you a group of other graves of the 5th and of the 6th centuries, which come from a site of part of the industrial part of Thessaloniki. Syndos is the district of Thessaloniki. Unfortunately, an area that was a rescue excavation where building has taken place since. We do not have the city that this is connected to, but it is an early predecessor of Thessaloniki, or a town that was quite close into Thessaloniki. A great number of graves. Some of these are on display in Thessaloniki. Some of you will have seen them. A great number more are under study. These graves have produced incredible riches. What we're looking at right here are from two different female graves. They are necklaces, obviously, of gold, and of this period, the 6th century, that we had really no inkling of, and certainly no suggestion that there was both the wealth, that there was the technical level that would produce these sorts of things, that there was the society that produced these sorts of things and that buried their dead at this early period in Macedonia. From this same graveyard, examples, dress pins from another lady's grave, and a detail looking down on the head of these dress pins. If you haven't had a chance to see them, haven't been to Thessaloniki, I hope you will. They are tremendously impressive, more than just pictures can show. And a few more from these. Together with these graves, there were many kinds of surprises. Let me share with you just one from a male grave. And the sword you see here is the kind of thing that turns up in male graves. A figure here, the helmet, that doesn't surprise us, but what does surprise us is that gold mask, which was found over the face of the skeleton, and the helmet, well, it had fallen off as the body had decomposed, but it was right at the head. This is the way the warrior was buried. Looking at it, I'm sure it will bring to mind something that is much, much earlier that I dare say we all know, namely the masks from the Mycenaean period, from more than 1,000 years earlier. The mask on the right screen here, which Schliemann, when he was excavating at Mycenae, way off in the Peloponnesus, when he found this in his shaft grave discoveries in the 19th century, believed he was looking on the face of Agamemnon. So, although we know for all sorts of reasons that isn't right and doesn't belong even in that period exactly, this kind of mask, when we have seen it, we have thought, of course, prehistoric. Well, what are we doing with these up in Macedonia now and in graves that are dated and date to the 6th and 5th centuries? This is a fascinating development. Such masks are known. A few other masks have been known, but very, very isolated. We're seeing these, we look at them, and we think there must be indeed be a connection back to prehistoric times. And I will let this just this suggestion and the notion that there is a connection back to prehistoric times stand for a whole subject which we don't have time to talk about this evening, and that is namely, well, turning the clock even further back before the 5th and 6th centuries, going back to the prehistoric period, the Mycenaean period in Macedonia. That too is enormously exciting, and we are learning a great deal there, and the relations, the depth of society in Macedonia, the chronological depth, but the depth of the whole culture itself, and by extension, naturally, the interrelationship between the Macedonians and the peoples who were much further south, the peoples of Mycenae, for instance. Leaving that question aside, fascinating as it is, looking at these masks, the first thought, you look at a mask and you think that's a very stylized mask, whether it's the so-called Agamemnon or whether it's these new masks from Sindos. And yet, if we look at the mask here from a female grave at Sindos and compare it to a contemporary statue made of terracotta, which is a fairly recent discovery in Macedonia, I think you can see there is a relationship between them. And we think of this as a burial mask over the face of a deceased. And I think we're getting closer in this way also to the real people, the real Macedonians, and something about what they looked like, certainly, in the course of finding out what their funerary customs were, what their lifestyle was like, as we excavate further and move into the cities that accompany these graves, which, in the case of Sindos, as I said, is a problem, as we cannot find that particular one. Macedonia is full of treasures, and we've seen only a few bits and pieces this evening of the many riches that are turning up now. The whole picture is vast. And the good news is, though, that we are at an important beginning in the last few years. There are great numbers of developments still to come. I feel certain we will be finding out more, particularly about the early history of Macedonia. And as a devoted Philhellene and as an archaeologist whose name, Stella, happens to mean star, I feel particularly gratified by this and a particular kind of connection in the discoveries we're making in Macedonia. Thank you very much for your attention. You should have lots of questions. We all have lots of questions. Yes?
I'd just like to ask you, one was about the new discoveries about the painting you mentioned earlier with the two voices. If you could elaborate a little on that, are they planning to get that perspective back then, which we thought came with the Renaissance? That was a question that came to mind. The other was, are you familiar with the archaeology of Maria Gambutis as popularized by me and Eisler, Chalice and Blake?
Those are both good questions. One has to do with the issue of perspective in ancient painting. You've touched on a subject that's very close to my heart. It's going to be hard to give you a short answer. And the other one is on the work of Maria Gimbutas, who takes a very broad and deep view of early society and culture throughout all of Europe, an enormously deep view. On the first one and the connection, the question was on the throne painting of the tomb, Eurydice, let's call it. Is there perspective? There is a kind of perspective, of course, as we see the horses coming out toward us and going into depth. It's not the same sort of perspective that we know from the Renaissance. We have paintings in other tombs that show shadowed and receding lines, but it is not the kind of systematic perspective, linear perspective that we know from that. It isn't quite as advanced as what happens in the Roman world. At least it isn't yet what we've discovered, but we need to keep going on that. The other question on Gimbutas's work and mother goddesses and substrata of culture, so on, is fascinating. And she basically, of course, is working with prehistoric materials. And I'm going to beg off a little bit in the sense that I myself am a classical archaeologist and not working with the specific kinds of questions she is asking there. But fortunately, classical archaeologists and prehistorians and theoretical archaeologists are all working much more closely together. And as we get more material, we are communicating better. So it will be something in the future that I think will be dealt with more. The question of the stars, my name, and how many points they have. Some have 12, some have 14, some have 16. Is there a significance in it? The star is used by the Macedonians, a popular motif that's used by the Macedonians, not just by the royals. It's found all over the place. And it's not just in Macedonia. It's found throughout the ancient Greek world, and it's found in the Near East with many different kinds of rays and points. And although we associate it now very closely with Macedonia, and it was used and popular there, it's not correct, strictly speaking, to call it just that. So the number of points and so on, when we have a bigger representative sampling, perhaps we can put together some sort of statistical survey. I don't know that it's going to get us anywhere, and at this point I doubt it, but maybe wrong. Yes, sir.
Two or three references to green looters. Are these higher hand for would be archaeologists that want to sit there universities higher than people to go to it, or are they looking for treasure so that they can log off to some strange part of the world to supply them? What are these looters? Who are they?
That's a tough question. It's a good question. Who are the looters? Hired hands, gangsters, what have you. Some of them at one end are the extended long arm of the dealers who sit in Switzerland and who sell to places around the world, museums around the world, and to private collectors. That's one part of it. Others are less sophisticated. Some of them are totally accidental, farmers who are digging in their own fields, in the back plots, of course, and come up with something that happens in Ohio, where I live, and the farmers will find Indian artifacts in plowing. What are you going to do? And so it comes about, and they, for a while, might have things sitting around on the mantelpiece, but then discover these are valuable, and if they're gold, of course, and they find ways that they can be sold, not for a great deal of money usually. The Greek Archaeological Service is trying very hard to keep control of this and to try to awaken the consciousness, shall we say, of the populace to realize that this is part of the national heritage and treasure of the country, and that these should be turned in to archaeological authorities to wind up ultimately in museums. But it's very difficult, and it goes on at local, small levels, and at larger levels too. Hard to control. It's a dirty business, if you ask me, though, all the way around.
Question right there in the middle.
Yes.
Thank you.
other was what? Excuse me? Yes. 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 Yes, the question of the tomb of Philip and the identity of the bones, the gold box that I showed you, the chest, in one of the first slides, comes from that tomb and contained, among other things, contained the charred bones, the partially cremated body of a male figure, mature male figure in his 40s, which have been studied certainly by physical anthropologists. The physical anthropologists have not entirely agreed among themselves on the nature of the wounds. Just like archaeologists, they don't agree exactly on issues. And of course, in the bottom line, this is a whole warrior society, and it wouldn't be surprising if there were wounds on any adult male. He will have been in battle. That was the way of life. That's one for starters. And secondly, the bones don't say anywhere on them that they are Philip. And unfortunately, wouldn't it be nice? Or even an inscription someplace in that tomb. But you know, again, here, there is hope also, in the sense that the tomb that is next to the tomb of Philip, the so-called tomb of the prince, it is called, contains, like the tomb of Philip, I use quotation marks around it, but you understand what I'm saying, simply because I think all the evidence is in, I don't take a side yet. There is a great deal of material still under study from these tombs, the unlooted tombs in the tumulus at Vergina. And just recently, in the course of studying some of the organic material from these tombs, they contained furniture, they contained wooden tables, they contained fabric of all sorts, they contained leather and material, which is very, very slow to work on and to restore. They've only recently, in the course of working on some of the organic material in the tomb that is next to the Philip tomb, found a fragment of papyrus. That, of course, is what we want. The papyrus that doesn't have just gibberish on it or a laundry list, but has on it names. So that is one possible hope we might have, or some other kind of object that could have a name on it. I suppose that's going to be the only way to satisfy everybody in the world. I don't mean to sound as though I doubt everything. I do question everything, though, and I teach my students, train my students to question everything. How do you know it? What's your evidence? And I think that's correct. Doesn't mean we have to say that it isn't. It leaves then the possibility for questions, and it makes us study and analyze and think about what the nature of real evidence is. So let's pray for a papyrus from the saying the right things from those tombs. Sorry? Yes. On the question of the Temple of Isis that I showed, the Roman temple at Dion, and is this indication of a religiously a tolerant society? In point of fact, Isis, as an Egyptian goddess, was among a variety of foreign gods who were taken into the Greek pantheon. And it wasn't just the Macedonians who did it. Athens took in a lot of foreign gods, including Egyptian gods, and they did it in a time of crisis. I guess it's what happens, isn't it, when you great crisis, the time of the Peloponnesian War in Athens, caused them to look anywhere where there might be possible further help. It was an interpretation of why they came in.
Right at the back there.
Yes, sir. I can't quite hear everything you're saying, I'm sorry. A concern about Yugoslavia, I heard. As an archaeologist and as a human being, my heart bleeds over this and other problems that exist in the world. And I think what we can do certainly is collectively hope for solutions to it. It's very, very difficult. I can't give you an answer. We're touching on very, very difficult political questions here that have depth. I would think perhaps this belongs in a different kind of forum. And I say that as a deep Philhellene. It's from Komotini. And it is in the Museum of Komotini. Was found by accident in digging for a new pipeline, sewer line or fresh water, I forget which, doesn't matter, I guess, under a road. And it is in the museum. Do I have the origin of the word Macedonia? The easy answer is it's connected to the eponymous hero Macedon, but of course, chicken and egg question, which came first? That's a difficult question, the origin of the word exactly, and is tied in naturally with the emergence of a recognizable tribe of the Greeks who call themselves the Macedonians. It's a good question, asking about the masks, the gold masks from Sindos, and the warrior mask in particular. Is this, how thick is the gold, and could it have been molded actually on the face, or is this an idealized portrait we're getting? I have not myself handled those masks. I have handled a mask that is like that. They are pliable, gold, and this is unworked, unalloyed gold. Which is so pure, it is very soft. It's not like foil, tin foil or something that you can ball together easily. It's thicker than that, and therefore it could not easily. You couldn't just lay it on a face and just rub your fingers across it. My guess, in truth, is that somewhere halfway between an idealized worked picture where the eyes have been rendered and putting over it. I don't mean to suggest that this is like a death mask that we think of pouring plaster over a face and getting the exact features. On the other hand, I am struck by what I see as a similarity in the features between the lady's face and the terracotta that I showed you. So someplace in between, perhaps.
I think we've got time for about two more questions. One up here.
Where? We don't know.
No,
Your questions, of course, are very very apropos in light of what's going on right now. The instant reaction that was going through my head was that these finds belong to the world, because I look on us as European, as I am, as many of us are, of European descent, that these are our ancestors. And so in a broader sense, it is that. And in a broader sense, a scientific sense, as I am working, and I, after all, am a foreigner who is working in Greece when I go there, that I feel this kind of heritage from a scientific point of view, working as an archaeologist. It's complex, I agree.
One question right here.
Yes, I'd like to know about one field that lets in the Western Park. They sing language with the place of peace in Athens, or what another part of the question is, speak the same language that time?
The question is the language of the ancient Macedonians. Which is not specifically my expertise, but I read and listen to what my colleagues say. There are conferences that take place on subjects like this by linguists from around the world. And the general consensus, it seems to me, the reasonable consensus is, sure, they spoke Greek. It's a dialect. This is my understanding of the rational view of specialists. Bear in mind, again, I am not a specialist. There are dialects today, aren't there? And some funny words can be used.
Now I'd like to call upon Professor Hector Williams of our Department of Classics at UBC to thank our speaker.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Speaker, 14 years ago, Professor Manolis Andronikos came to Vancouver, spoke to an audience of some 800 people, some of whom are here tonight at the Hotel Vancouver. What Professor Miller Collett has done for us this evening is to give us a splendid update on what has happened in Macedonia in the last 14 years, and the splendid discoveries that Greek archaeologists have been making in a variety of fields there. The rich contributions of ancient Macedonia to European civilization, and indeed to world civilization, can be seen in the material that we viewed tonight. And I think we all owe Professor Miller Collett a great vote of thanks to bring us this update on what's happening in Greek archaeology today. On behalf of us all, thanks again. We look forward to your lecture on Monday night, which is up on the board here.